are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 2nd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Emily Gundelsberger, author of On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. Also on the program today, Trump taking heat over those 2,000 Facebook ads citing an invasion at our border. Meanwhile, a Trump superfan given 20 years for sending bombs to prominent Democrats. Forgot about that one.
I didn't.
That's indeed. As the top USDA physiologist quits over climate science suppression by the Trump administration, the USDA inspector general says the office relocation scheme is illegal. Post-debate polling is out. Warren won the battle. Not quite the war. U.S. expands to a full embargo of Venezuela. This is the first embargo in the Western Hemisphere in 30 years. And with China, trade war escalates. Treasury designates the China a currency manipulator. And the Trump National Labor Relations Board may rule that Scabby the Rat is illegal. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Gerald Nadler predicts an impeachment decision by the Judiciary Committee by late fall. And people beginning to fear mass oppression in Kashmir following the quashing of part of the Indian Constitution that gave Kashmir autonomy by Prime Minister Modi. All this and more on today's program. I don't want to freak people out, but one of the things that I distinctly remember when Donald Trump became president was that we're about to find the answer to the question of just like how long would it take for things to see the impact of having a completely incompetent president, to see that impact on the world stage. And, counterfactuals are very, very difficult. It's possible under anybody's presidency that we would see this type of very scary escalation on the horizon with India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Or that we could be on the horizon. We see on the horizon the potential for China to unleash its army in Hong Kong, which could happen at any time. Turkey invading Syria at any time. North Korea beginning to ramp up their missile program again. All of these things have happened at various times over the years. Maybe not so much the Turkey invasion, but more or less. But the idea that all of these potential fairly major crises, you know, Pakistan and India probably being one of the most dangerous, is a little scary. Iran, of course, also continuing to like board ships or we had South Korea firing missiles at the military firing at Russian planes. There's a lot of different things going on in the world that could end up being super problematic in the next 4 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to know whether the absence of a functioning U.S. State Department has anything to do with that.
Well, but I think also the fact that, again, though, they are ideologically synchronized, right? Like Trump, Modi, Bolsonaro are definitely part of the same global trend. And, you know, obviously more competence, maybe. Like, I don't think there's any particular investment that Trump has. In fact, he would like to have a deal in Kashmir, even though obviously he knows nothing about it for his own aggrandizement. But in general, governments are coming to power that are making commitments doing these sort of things, and they're doing it.
Right, right. I mean, and maybe they're encouraged on some level by the fact that Trump is, you know, if he understood what was going on, would be like, yeah, it sounds like something I'd do. But also it could just be like there's no countervailing forces to go in and say, hey, let's chill out a little bit here. We're going to just sell arms to everybody involved in this conflict and everybody will feel better or something like that. So I don't know. I mean, it's myriad of things to freak you out this week. Add those to it. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show. As a reminder, you can get the fun half, which supposedly will let a little air out of the tires, hopefully. More often than not.
That's what they say.
Not necessarily, but a little air out of the tires to that by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And speaking of which, you know, the right has been on a real tear as of late because of the minimum wage. Like I say, the best thing about that is that they are promoting the fact that the Democrats actually voted to raise the minimum wage $15 an hour. I think Nancy Pelosi couldn't have hoped for more. They passed 60 bills. None of them got any attention except for the rising of the minimum wage. And why is that? Because, one, the idea that people would be, that labor would in any way be empowered. And I did a fascinating interview on what happened with the car industry in the United States. We're going to run that during vacation at the end of the month. But it's fascinating. The obsession with getting the cheapest labor costs possible is stunning. And of course, you know, the dynamic really to look at, right? I mean, a dollar figure is just a dollar figure. It doesn't mean anything without a sense of like how much this thing costs and how much productivity is there. Productivity is basically like how much money is being generated by a company. And then you start thinking about the share of labor in that productivity. How much of profits essentially are going to, or revenue is going to labor relative to the productivity and to the overall share of revenue. And we know that even at $15 a minimum wage, workers are still getting less of a share of productivity or relative to productivity than they were 40 years ago. But yet they're very concerned because, you know, like you never, like the Wall Street Journal has a piece today about how 6 months later, people are really worried about the rise in the minimum wage. Now, there's no data. They just interview like two or three people who are like, yeah, I'm sort of worried. And then somebody from the Chamber of Commerce who's like, yeah, this is bad.
It's a lot of concerns. A
lot of concerns. You don't see people at Fox News talking about rental real estate prices in New York that are driving businesses out. It's always labor costs are too much. Here is Stuart Varney again on Fox and Friends. And it's always great to see the Fox and Friends people feel this is personal. And they feel these tragedies. Here is Ainsley Earhart talking about her friend again.
One of my best friends lives down in Florida. She has a chicken salad restaurant. They sell chicken salad. I asked her, could you survive if you increase it to $15 an hour? She said, absolutely not. It would take us under. She said, granted, the employees I have that work really hard, that do a wonderful job, they do get paid a little bit more, and she gives pay raises. Mm-hmm. But you got to earn that.
Don't let politicians set wage levels.
Okay, pause it for a second. Wait a second. So I'm unclear what Ainsley is saying at the end here. They actually get paid 15, the minimum wage?
Oh, not 15, Sam. They might get like 14.25 if they're a really hard worker.
But you got to earn it.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? Like, here's the thing.
Opportunity.
Well, what does it mean?
Chicken salad sandwich place.
What percentage of your productivity do you deserve? Right? Like, you never hear this that concept even come up in these situations because it is completely random.
It's basically charity.
In a chicken salad sandwich shop, my understanding is that
I'm
you could actually, I'm trying to pretend like that's not hilarious.
Where do you get the names of the sandwiches?
The chicken salad sandwich shop, you could assess how many sandwiches are my employees making per hour and what is my profit on that or what is my revenue on it? And I can find out how much of that revenue is dedicated to labor. That delta between your revenue and what you pay labor is whatever you as a chicken salad sandwich shop owner deem it should be. And now, I imagine, do you think she has a tiny shop or do you think that she has 100 affiliates across the country?
I guess there's somewhere around 100 franchises.
100 franchises?
Chicken salad shops across the globe. So.
First of all, the idea that a chicken salad restaurant.
It's everywhere.
Only chicken salad.
What more could you ask for?
It's in every Mayo state in the union.
I'm sorry, maybe your business is not meant to survive. Like
now all of a sudden you're Varney here. Maybe you all are supposed to stay in the marketplace.
Well, I mean, my bottom line is, and I felt this as a waiter, but my feeling was like, if you're going out to eat and you can't afford to leave at least 15% tip, then you just got to find a less expensive restaurant. That's basically like my food. Like that's part of
the Shark Tank.
That's yeah, exactly. That's part of the cost of going out there. And part of the cost of doing business is you pay your employees. And well, let's hear where Varney's going with this.
One of my best friends lives down in Florida. She has a chicken salad restaurant. They sell chicken salad. I asked her, could you survive if you increase it to $15 an hour? She said, absolutely not. It would take us under. She said, granted, the employees I have that work really hard, that do a wonderful job, they do get paid a little bit more, and she gives pay raises.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to earn
she
that.
She gives pay
Don't
raises.
Let politicians set wage levels. Because they're basically buying votes. They're saying, hey, you vote for me, and look what you get. You will get a raise. You'll get $15 an hour.
That sounds like a... Yeah, it's not like we didn't watch President Trump walk through the 21st Century Club. Is that what that's called? The 21 Club? To people eating like $500 dinners. Literally tapping, I'm going to cut all your taxes. Give me a break.
And I can tell just by Ainsley Earhart's personality that her friend is the worst boss ever.
Who knows? Who knows?
If you're not committed to the mission of selling chicken salads, then you don't belong here. If it's just about the money and not the idea of putting the best chicken salad on a plate that can be put on a plate, then you should not be in this business.
But it's better than buying votes. This is buying votes with capitalists' money.
Yeah. Even better.
Make them give
it to the money. Now, we did a little research. We don't know if it's the same company. I want to be clear about this. However, Ainsley Earhart did visit and promote a chicken salad restaurant in the Glades, Florida. Is that what it's called?
The Villages.
The Villages. Well, I don't know where that is. Somewhere in the Florida.
It's in hell.
And it's a very hoity-toity place. And we just looked up that company. And this company, what is the chicken salad? Now, it may not be her.
It might not be her, but Chicken Salad Chick is at least the first one that comes up on Google.
There could be multiple chicken salad restaurants in Florida.
Which might also be a problem.
That are also friendly with Ainsley Earhart.
I try to keep my business.
Once you get into that chicken salad.
I try to be friends with everybody in the chicken salad cartel.
But we just saw an article about that Chicken Salad Chick. And they gave $100,000 to charity to deal with cancer.
Cancer and hunger.
And good for them. But I have another suggestion that businesses are not responsible first for charity. They're first responsible for paying their workers. And so pay your workers. If that $100,000 doesn't cover it, which, boy, you got a lot of workers. And you're paying them very little amount of money.
Locations.
But if that $100,000 doesn't cover it, don't worry. I mean, you don't have anything left because we're going to tax those workers. We'll take some of that money, and then you promote cancer research by the government. And then think of how that money travels to getting to those that cancer research. It goes into your employees' pockets. Then they pay it out to someone else who's got another business. It goes in sales tax. It goes in wage taxes. Everybody gets paid. And then the money still ends up going to cancer research.
Sam, do you understand logic?
Oh, my God. I'm just looking at the menu right now, and it's like so much mayonnaise. It's making me a little bit nauseous.
A good place for that in Florida.
I feel like I'm on too much tuna right now. I'm being pranked.
Folks, the World Health Organization has named the health epidemic of the 21st century. Do you know what it is? Anybody?
Is it a
stress, Michael?
Stress. Michael knows it. That's what they tell you as soon as you go into your silent retreat.
That's right.
We're feeling more uncertainty and anxiety than ever before. We're going to hear more about that with our guest today, actually. That's why we're partnering with Calm. It's the number one rated app for meditation. When you meditate, your brain chemistry changes. Meditation has been shown to slow down the release of stress chemicals into your bloodstream, like cortisol and adrenaline, giving you much-needed relief. With Calm, you discover a whole library of simple, guided meditations on themes like anxiety, creativity, and focus. They even have other resources to help you relax, like sleep stories, music, and more. So if you're stressed, take a deep breath and get calm. Right now, Majority Report listeners get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/majority. That's calm.com/majority. 40 million people have downloaded Calm. Find out why at calm.com/majority. Also, we all want a haven, a place that feels uniquely you, right?
Of course, Sam.
With Joybird, you get one-of-a-kind furniture crafted to your unique taste. Now, we're lucky. We got a Joybird store right down the street here. Have you been to this one?
The one in DeKalb.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I love it. All the furniture I found, incredibly comfortable. Yeah, I wanted to check it out to make sure that we weren't gangsters,
and they were like, "What are you doing here? Are you planning on buying anything?" And we're like, "Don't worry,
we're gonna sit on everything.
Jump on the couch just so we can be honest with our listeners."
But here's the thing that's amazing about Joybird: you have your ideas for your apartment, you can turn them into reality because they have hundreds of styles and options. They have rich buttery leather to the plushest velvet you've ever felt. You want a sofa in aquatic blue? no problem. A love seat in bubblegum pink. If you can dream it, Joybird can make it a reality. They even have a beautiful section of outdoor sofas, lounge chairs, and tables. Plus, free personal design consultants can help you nail down your design. Joybird offers a range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery options. Oh, now you tell me. So that your creations can stand the test of time. Best of all, thanks to their 365-day home trial. If you don't love your Joybird, you can return it for a full refund. See how Joybird can help you design your dream space. Find your joy today at joybird.com/majority. You can create the furniture that brings you joy. That's joybird.com/majority. Receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code majority. joybird.com/majority. Check it out, folks. And don't I know it? School is coming back. But breakouts don't have to. With America's number one acne brand, Proactiv has helped fight acne for almost 25 years. Now, I have not been in the acne business for some time, but my daughter is. And now is the time where she's focusing on, you know, get the skin clear. Going to high school, want to represent. Proactiv has introduced their next generation acne treatment system called Proactiv MD. Proactiv MD contains adapalene, which is a dermatologist recommended topical retinoid used in the treatment of mild to moderate acne. It's the first prescription strength retinoid that is FDA approved for use in treating acne without a prescription. And it works by affecting the growth of cells and decreasing acne inflammation. Kelly writes me, she's been using Proactiv on and off since high school. And she says the formula's improved over the years, but the ideas remain the same. It's a program of skincare that gives you short and long-term results. It's the best acne-fighting product that doesn't require a prescription, and it's been that way for a long time. Kelly apparently has sensitive skin, and she says that Proactiv's program has made my skin smoother and clearer without causing redness or peeling. And as she says, it's the perfect time of the year to start Proactiv for many people because school's starting up soon, like I say, same with Myla. It only takes a few weeks to achieve noticeable differences in your skin. Confidence makes all the difference. Going back to school with noticeably clearer skin leaves one less thing to worry about. Proactiv is so reliable. It fights acne and improves the brightness and overall appearance of my skin, she writes, it's the best regimen I've ever used. Well, right now we have a back-to-school offer from Proactiv that you cannot get anywhere else. With your Proactiv MD order, you'll also receive Proactiv's on-the-go bag, which features their T-Zone oil absorber, body acne wipes, and green tea moisturizer for free. That's close to $100 worth of of products. Plus, get free shipping with a 60-day money-back guarantee. So just go to proactiv.com/majority. That's Proactiv, proactiv.com/majority to order and make the first day back to school the best day ever. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Emily Gundelsberger on her book, On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I found my notes. All is good. And on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program the journalist and author of On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane, Emily Gundelsberger. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's just start with how you got into writing the book and what you did, because this is I want to say it's an ethnography, but it's a little bit more than that. But tell us how you started to write the book and what you did actually to report on low wage work.
Sure. So Nickel and Dimed has always been, it's always sort of had a very foundational effect on my writing. I read it when I was a kid, and it really had a big effect on me, particularly the way she, Barbara Ehrenreich, right, was able to sort of take all of these like things that it's sort of difficult for people or difficult or embarrassing for workers to complain about individually, like every, you know, grain of sand is hard to, like, you know, show it to someone and be like, this is awful. But, you know, when you are buried in sand, it gets really heavy and hard. So that's one of the things that I really loved about that book was the way that, you know, it showed how people got nickel and dimed by just this system that we live in and how it's different than something it's harder to complain about, and that it's harder because of that, it's harder to take action on it. So that has always had like a really big effect on my writing. In particular, I like doing a lot of first person experiential stuff. One of the things that allowed me to actually write the book was I was working at Philadelphia City Paper back in 2015, RIP. That year, I published this piece on Uber, for which I was trying to sort of fact check the claim that they were throwing around at the time that their average driver made $90,000 a year, which did not seem correct to me. The data was really hard to get because so much of it is individual, because all of these drivers are technically, you know, their own little companies or whatever. So they're supposed to be keeping track of all of their costs, including, you know, paying extra taxes because you're technically a small business, and the depreciation on your car, the amount of money you're spending on gas, just all of these little things that, like, human brains aren't particularly great at dealing with. We just are not particularly well evolved to, like, look at huge numbers or tiny numbers, especially not to look at how they build up over time. So anyway, I did that, and I signed up for Uber just so I could get some, like, data that I could really, you know, get behind and trust. So I did that, worked for Uber for a couple months on and off, and eventually turned up that I, on average, made between $9 and $10 an hour, right, which, like, you cannot make $90,000 a year doing that, even if you work every single hour of every single day of a year. So, yeah, and that, like, got a lot of attention, and I got some interest from publishers. It had not really even occurred to me that writing a book was a thing that I could do. I honestly kind of thought that was for rich New York people, despite being the sort of writer who consistently turns everything in about, like, twice the word count that she was given. So books are actually kind of an ideal place for me. But so then I was interested in doing the same sort of thing. I got really fascinated when I was doing Uber with the way that the driver side platform has these really, like, sneaky and subtle methods of controlling the drivers while sort of maintaining this facade of, like, oh, they're just, you know, they're all freelancers. They're, right, they're just, like, you know, plumbers. They're, you know, individuals in a market, and, you know, which is, again, super ridiculous because the app absolutely pressures you to take rides that aren't in your interest, that, and it doesn't give you enough information about every ride. Yeah. To actually make a decision about whether a ride is in your best interest or not. Again, like those, all of those gig economy companies are pretty much structured along those lines of like, oh, they're all just, we're just a platform for everybody to, for all these, you know, small business people to use. And if you haven't actually used the driver side app, I could understand why you would sort of take their word for it, because, you know, drivers, it's very hard for drivers to complain. And also, whenever you talk to your Uber drivers or Lyft drivers or anybody in the gig economy, they probably like what they're doing, because if they don't, they would have left. Because it, yeah, it's kind of a sample bias on that one.
Right.
So I ended up going, I was fascinated by that, and I got really interested in doing the book about the various ways that technology is used in other workplaces, like the subtle ways that it controls people, that people who, for example, like have, you know, power in this country, by definition, are not likely to have had a service job in the past, you know, 15 years or so, which is sort of around the period where this sort of techno-Taylorism is what I call it, has gotten like really, really, really extreme, and has made work just really miserable in ways that I don't think it's possible to really understand unless you have actually experienced it. So I tried to
when you say techno-terrorism, and I'm glad, I mean, because that really, if there's one word to say what the difference between the jobs, the nickel and diming of the nickel and dimed era and today, it's technology, right? It's just, it is the granular nature in which that nickeling and diming happens now. It's like down to like the 0.5 cents as opposed to 5 yeah. cents. It's like 0.5 cents, 0.1 cents. But Frederick Taylor, when you say techno Taylor, just tell people who Taylor was.
Taylor was basically the first management consultant, sort of, at least certainly the first one who really had a really big effect on the American economy. He was from Philly, like me, and he was a pretty interesting and very, very strange person. One of the interesting things that I found in my research for this book of sort of the history of management is like all these guys were total freaks. Like they were all just huge weirdos the way work is now has been sort of shaped around their ideas. But again, they're all total weirdos. Like Taylor, for example. All right. So what Taylor was is he sort of started out in steel mills, and he started timing each individual motion in every task that a worker was doing in the steel mill, no matter how small it was. And he was able to do that because of technology, because right about that time, like it was the 1890s, I believe, was when he first started doing this. And that was because there were like stopwatches had just come out that were both accurate and pretty affordable. Before that, it wasn't really a thing that you even could do, like time every worker's movement by the second. So he started timing, like he would get the best workers on the payroll, and he would pay them double to work as fast as they possibly can for like a few hours so that he could time them, figure out what the best, he called it the one best way. And he would basically from the numbers that he put down about like how fast workers could technically go if they were the best and they were going as fast as they possibly can. And he used those to sort of extrapolate what he thought the average worker should be doing every day. And it was usually like two or three times what they were doing at the time. So when I say techno-Taylorism, like Taylor's, like, he calls it scientific management. And so that idea, like, that if you leave workers to do anything on their own, if you trust them, if you give them any agency, they're just going to screw around and, like, go slow and, you know, like, just misbehave in general, like they're children or something. And it sort of, like, overlooks the fact that, at least certainly now, a lot of people really, it's this, like, very American thing to take a lot of sort of pride in your work, even when there's, like, almost no pride to be found in it these days, because it's all been sort of squeezed dry by Taylorism. Like, in particular, like, he got rid of a lot of the skill involved in jobs. Like, he would make equipment that, so instead of, like, being able to having to hire someone who knows how to use a drill or, like, smelt or, you know, be able to work the equations for how to create steel, he got slide rulers and equipment that was specially made so that, like, it was very, very easy to use, so you could hire low wage or, like, rather unskilled workers to do it. And that sort of broke the power that skilled workers had over factory operations at that time.
And people should know that Taylor ended up being sort of like, you know, Henry Ford's guy, essentially.
Yeah.
And all right. But so, okay. So this, we have this concept of techno-Taylorism where that is taking, is viewing human workers as potential machines on some level, essentially, like literally cogs, and trying to find out what is the most efficient position that you could put this cog in to get the most productivity out of it without contemplating its humanity and just sort of making certain assumptions about them. And the techno version, of course, is aided by computers and technology, which, you know, there's so many different phenomena that we have seen over the past 10 or 15 years that has dramatically changed, that is changed by technology to the point where it has gone from one thing and it's moved so far down the spectrum that it's actually become another. I mean, just like gerrymandering, for instance, just comes to mind, where everybody gerrymandered, but in 2010, they were able to gerrymander because of technological advances and, cross-referencing data files. They were able to do it in such a way that was, made it almost a fundamentally different exercise than had been done in the past. But, all right, so with that said, what the three jobs that you took, one was at an Amazon warehouse in Kentucky, one was at a call center in Hickory, North Carolina, and one was at a Mickey D's in downtown San Francisco. Why those three?
Well, Amazon was obviously my first choice because they are kind of the obvious one. So when I started in 2015, I don't feel like the tide of public opinion had really started to turn in the same way it is now. It's been fascinating to watch how people have sort of started objecting to or sort of started treating them the same as Walmart.
Yep.
When it comes to their workforces. Like, there was this really interesting memo by Jeff Bezos that's in this sort of history of Amazon called the Everything Store. And it's called Amazon.love is this memo. And he sent it to his, senior people. And it's about basically why some companies are loved and others are kind of despised, like Walmart and versus, you know, Apple or something. And he sort of concluded that the perception of the company as, you know, kind of a small, scrappy, innovative business is what is really key to basically having cover to treat workers however you want without getting constantly, you know, harassed by the press in the same way Walmart is, or just like not having that reputation as like this sort of like crappy employer. And it's been, again, really fascinating to watch things turn against them, these past couple years because, yeah, they are the big guy now. They are by far the bigger than Walmart right. these days, and they're going to take over. So, yeah, Amazon was – and also Amazon has – just from what I talked to people, like I talked to a lot of workers before I did any of these jobs. And the people at Amazon, like especially when you start looking up places where Amazon workers go to talk about their jobs, they talked about it in a way that was just really different than the way people talked about other jobs that they did not like. It was really interesting because they are generally like by the actual workers themselves are generally regarded as comparatively safe for warehouse work. Like the conditions are generally held up as pretty good, and the benefits and pay were also regarded as pretty good. Even back when, you know, when I was doing my time in SDF8, which is the name of my fulfillment center, like that was back when I was making, everybody was making like $10.50 an hour who was there for peak. And that was still regarded as comparatively pretty good.
Right.
So they are kind of but still people talked about that place as if they hated it so much more than they hated other warehouses.
So,
and it was because they're treated like robots. Like if you look at any of the protests that happened on Prime Day or any of the protests that have happened in Europe that have been sort of on a larger scale, like the sort of unofficial slogan is "We are humans, not robots." Like that is what they want, is to be allowed to be human workers rather than sort of being so tightly held to these timings and trackings that, you know, anything is regarded as any deviation from sort of being a perfect robot is regarded as kind of laziness and slacking and time theft.
Well, let's talk about your experience there and then we'll get to the other places. I mean, but it does. So basically when we talk about Amazon on paper, by the standards in which we have looked at businesses in the past, it seems like it would be a pretty decent place to work, right? Not a lot of, but we've heard now of like attempted suicides, that some of these places actually need to have like an ambulance on call or something for this. And it has to do with the level of control that is exerted. According to what you've reported and written, tell us how that plays out. I mean, just seems to be like, put aside the fact that someone's getting paid to work there and put aside, it's almost like an experiment on how you could sort of make human beings disassociate from themselves.
Actually, somebody I talked to in the book actually said that, or rather that Amazon in his theory was a giant social experiment on how much you could like make people do for a single fucking dollar, I believe were his words. Wait, can I swear? I'm sorry.
Yes, you can.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So at Amazon, so I'll just describe sort of how my job went. I was a picker. In new fulfillment center, that's like a stationary job, but in frankly, most of them that were not built in the last few years, it is a walking job. So you basically push this cart around this incredibly huge modular storage system. They call it the mod. And you have a big bin on your cart, and you have a scanner, just an RFID scanner. It looks like something you'd find at the grocery. So you carry this scan gun around with you, and there's an LCD screen on the back, and it basically says every task you have to do, which is just, you know, going to find that item, is subdivided into like four or five different steps, and each step is timed. And it's not just timed. There is actually a little bar at the bottom of the scanner that just constantly counts down the seconds that you have remaining to finish that part of the task. And it just never stops. Like, there is no pause button. It is real. Again, like, it's kind of embarrassing to say this, honestly, because I was raised with a very, like, just, you know, put up, like, work hard, don't complain, et cetera. And I have gotten a lot of people who have responded to the book with, like, ugh, millennial whining. Ugh. But this is one of those things where it is very difficult to describe how stressful that is, especially because the whole point of that countdown is that if you can keep ahead of it, then that means you're making rate, which means you're picking as many items an hour as Amazon like predicts that you should be able to do.
And so, and it's just to be clear, yeah. I'm just on the process. So it's mm-hmm. four steps. So it's, in other words, like, get the list of the product that you need, right? Hair dryer. And
yeah, it just pops right up on your screen.
And then make it to aisle number 7 by this amount of time. And
yes,
then
they give you like basically coordinates, like these like 5-dimensional coordinates you have to go find the item with.
And so what are the 4 different stages, though, of that? Like, assess what you need, find the bin that you need, climb the ladder. Like, what are the 4 things that you're under like the clock for?
So it's just like basically different steps, like you, and they all end with a scan of some sort of barcode. So you scan to start a new tote. And then once you've scanned that, your description of the item and the like 5-dimensional coordinates where to find it pop up on your screen, and the countdown starts. So you navigate to wherever the drawer is. And again, the mod is just crazy looking. It is honestly very, very fascinating and cool looking. There's just these shelves, these cardboard shelves, and you just look in any direction and you can't really see the end of them. It's crazy looking. So you navigate around and you find the correct drawer. You scan the drawer. And then you pull it open, you look inside, and there's usually just my SDF-8, the one I worked at, was almost all clothing. So everything, you'll open the drawer, and inside there'll be this like weird mix of like 15 random articles of clothing, because this is actually a very smart way of doing it, because it's really easy to pick a pair of black socks out of like a bunch of hats and baby clothes and stuff, rather than like finding a drawer with 15 black socks in them and having to find the right size.
Right.
So yeah, so you find the drawer, you scan the drawer, and then a new countdown starts, and you got to find the correct item and scan the correct barcode on it. And then you scan that, you throw it in the bin, another countdown starts, and then you scan your tote, and then you go on to the next one.
Now, I would imagine it depends, like, right, like the machine knows, like, oh, okay, you're a quarter of a mile or 500 yards away from where the socks are, but you should get there in 24 seconds. Like, what's the average interval that we're talking about here?
Sort of depended on the path that you take around the warehouse. Like, it's called a pick path, and it's sort of set by algorithms that both, you know, try to make it the most convenient and close to each other path as possible. Like, I cannot even imagine how much went into making the stuff that makes Amazon run. Like, programming that is,
right,
it's insane. But anyway, so it directs you around the warehouse, and it also kind of keeps you.
But how many seconds?
Very like, close to other people.
It's like 3
how
minutes?
How many seconds? It really depends. Like, I think the max I ever had was 2 minutes, but that was to go. That was on a weird day where
that's
were all
nuts.
Going back and forth.
So
yeah,
you just get
really
a series.
It was usually more like 15 or 30 or something.
So if you get a so basically what happens is, for every task you do over the course of an hour, you are looking at, like, you're getting, I guess it seems like you're getting, let's say, 30 to 40 articles, and each one of them goes.
No, it was much more than that. Rate was usually like 90 or 100 an hour.
So 90 to 100 an hour, and each one has 4 steps that is timed with seconds, and there's no break, right? You just flow from one to another.
Right.
Yeah, that sounds like how anybody could hear that and not think that would drive you crazy. Like, you know that show Lost?
Yeah.
They had,
you know, you are not the first person to bring that up. Yeah.
They pressed that button where it's coming down to zero. And for a long time, that's the way I would describe this job when it was driving me crazy. Cause like every day at noon, I got to press that button and the show's going and we got to be ready. The idea that you would have four of those like deadlines in the context of like a minute or two or less is insane. It seems to me.
Yeah. Like it is incredibly stressful, you know, like it is, especially because for a lot of people, you know, their jobs do depend on being able to maintain rate. And it's also just like, they're very good at sort of designing things to be stressful. Like they're purposely meant to make you stressed because that's how you're, you know, the best worker is when you are, you know, very motivated to make rate. But yeah, so that's making rate. Wow. And,
okay. So let's talk about, the call center. What, tell us about the, well, first off, why a call center? Why that one in North Carolina? And then let's talk about what, you know, what you experienced there.
So call centers are one of those, places where everything is really, really, really tracked and monitored, obviously. But I thought it was really, it was very interesting how you were supposed to sort of repress all of your humanity, not just in the sense like, oh, I have to walk around an Amazon warehouse for, you know, between 6:30 a.m. and 6 p.m. and they expect you to walk 15 miles a day and not talk to anybody and keep up with these countdowns and not even like listen to music. We weren't allowed to have anything distracting in there with us. We weren't allowed to have anything that Amazon sold. So that will drive you nuts. But the repression, like the sort of repression of humanity that's involved with something, with trying to like put objective metrics on something that's as sort of confusing and complicated as human conversation, I found really fascinating. So I picked a place called Convergys because it was the biggest third-party like outsourcing company. It's like really big. It's the biggest one in the that has jobs in the U.S. So I honestly I picked the my Amazon location just because somebody like somebody's aunt offered me a room and I was broke. But Hickory, like I didn't really have that many. Like I didn't have a contact that like would offer me a room near any of the like several or couple hundred Convergys places, Convergys being the call center, sorry. And so I just picked Hickory sort of, I don't know, why not? It had a really interesting history as sort of the center of the American furniture industry. Like it's the furniture cluster is what it's called, and it's in Western North Carolina. And that is an area that's been particularly just decimated by globalization. And NAFTA in particular. So a lot of communities that are in the same situation in that like there used to be a lot of manufacturing jobs that no longer exist. Like call centers are really one of the things that they try to get into replace those jobs. So that it's pretty those are pretty common in places like Hickory that have a lot of like, you know, dead manufacturing.
Give us a sense of what you experienced there. And we should be clear, like, you're not working here for months and months.
I did about a month at each one, a little longer at Convergys and McDonald's than at Amazon. Amazon was, second of December to Christmas Eve.
Okay.
Which I feel the need to do it because Amazon has been coming after me with like, accusations that I didn't work there long enough to understand how bad it was, which doesn't really make that much sense to me.
I want to note that. And when we talk about, after we talk about the different jobs, I want to just talk about the implications of being there,
like why it's different just being there for that period of time as opposed
to
like, but all right. So tell us about the call center.
So the call center was another reason that I picked call centers was because the stress involved with that, like particularly Convergys, but a lot of third party outsourcing call centers, like for profit ones that aren't associated with actually, you know, helping a specific company's customers specifically solve their problems. Like third party call centers, you usually have a lot of other things that you're supposed to be doing rather than just help the customers. Like you're supposed to be trying to sell them stuff and you're supposed to be trying to keep these crazy metrics down because the company gets paid by how many calls you take in a day. So it's really, really closely timed and it's really, really mentally stressful, like both in the sense that you're constantly multitasking across about like 8 different things. My workplace in particular was really difficult because the computer systems were so like poorly integrated. So you would like the sequence that you had to get through just when somebody beeps into your headset. And again, you do not really have a choice about when someone beeps into your headset any more than you did when, you know, you're walking around Amazon, like that new job coming into your scanner, like it just comes in and you're on and there's no pause button. So yeah, like the mental stress people talked about specifically with Convergys online, like a lot of people mentioned like depression, anxiety, and in particular, like suicidal ideation from the sort of abuse that they had to put up with at these jobs. Like, in fact, like the perfect workplace that is usually used for studies involving job stress, like mental job stress, is actually call centers because it is the perfect example of a low control, high pressure job. Like in mine in particular, you were not allowed to hang up on customers for any reason, no matter what they said to you. And that is not great because it's not just that you get yelled at like and cussed out a few times a day. It's that after that happens enough times to you, every single time a new customer beeps into your headset, regardless of whether they are going to scream at you or not, you kind of have this fight or flight reaction, like, oh, like, ah, crap, it's another one. This is another one that could be a screamer. Like, it makes you kind of paranoid, I guess. Mm. But yeah, so what I did was answer calls for AT&T, which is actually my own cell phone provider. So I would answer calls of people who were calling in with problems, usually with their bill. And during that, I would have to try to also sell them DirecTV or some sort of upgrade on their account. And you would have to try to fix their problem and sell them something at the same time. And it gets super exhausting.
Wow. And what were the hours like on something like that? Like what were the other forms of control you've got? I mean, they keep sending you calls. Like, what if you got to go to the bathroom? What if you're like, you know what? I need to go buy a pack of M&Ms to stay awake or whatever it is.
Well, we actually got yelled at a lot for what's called toggling. And that's because they don't, you know, give you a pause button for, you know, if you need to use the bathroom, if you need to buy M&Ms, if you need to like go weep in the bathroom because someone just like called you horrible names and it gets to you. So everything is also really closely tracked, which includes the time that you spend not logged into the phones. They only get paid by AT&T apparently for the number of like the exact minutes that the customers or that the reps spend actually taking calls. So any downtime, like when you're in the bathroom or whatever, is and like was explicitly referred to as like time theft, which is another super charming term. Like that was actually, like, the first time I'd heard of it was in Nickel and Dimed, because Walmart had sort of pioneered the idea of trying to rebrand any downtime as, like, stealing from the company somehow.
As opposed to the sort of built-in sort of assumption that one might have, like, I've got people working for me. I can expect that, you know, 2% of the time that they're there is going to be spent in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Because they're human beings.
Exactly. Or honestly, just like saying hi to a coworker or chilling or something, or taking a couple minutes to like relax after a really stressful call. Like, these are all extremely human things, right, that are very natural, but they are definitely looked at as like moral failings now that we've gotten so creepily good at measuring them.
How did your fellow workers and how did you like react to the idea of being accused of time theft? Like, were people like, "Oh, F that guy," or "F that, that supervisor. I don't care. I'll go to the bathroom when I want to." Or did people actually feel guilty? Like, what is the reaction that people have?
Well, I think it depended on the person, but it wasn't like there definitely wasn't like, "Oh, F that guy" sort of thing, because you had a report every single day sent to your manager of all the time, the exact minutes that you spent logged into the phone versus logged out of the phone. So they would know if you spent time in the bathroom, and you would hear about it, like, for real. But one of the things that I find the most irritating, I think, about the general mindset, I think, of sort of neoliberalism, this idea that like workers are naturally like lazy and terrible, and like they're just out to, like, you know, steal your time and will screw around. Again, like this sort of Taylorism idea is that like the people that I met at these jobs, like, they were such good workers. They were so much better at, you know, like putting up with this shit than I was, which, again, if I had not been able to like get into white collar jobs in my mid 20s, I would also like, I think, be a more, I guess, like, I would be less outraged, because if I was outraged all the time, it would drive you insane. Do right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, you know, to the extent that on one hand you have an advantage, because you're like, I'm only here for a month. Like, I'm just dropping in, I'm parachuting in. I'm gaining a book out of this experience. As much as I'm getting driven crazy, I'm going to turn it into a story. At the same time, I wonder too, if you weren't more sensitive to how crappy it was because you'd actually been in a situation where it's like, "Oh, you need to go to the bathroom? You don't need to tell me. In fact, I don't want to know. Just go." That type of situation. Yeah. I mean, did you wrestle with that idea? Like, that sort of dichotomy of like how much your awareness of how bad it was, like that they were, I mean, I imagine for a lot of these people, they've come from, you know, they go work at the Amazon factory after they've worked at a call center, or they're working at the Amazon factory after they've worked at a fast food restaurant. And they're like, "This is just all I've known. I didn't realize that like you could go and work at a place where you don't have to ask, you know, like not only do you have to not ask for permission to go to the bathroom, but you're not chastised for it.
And you're not timed by the second on everything. Like, you are trusted to get, like when I was a reporter at a newspaper, I was trusted to get my work done. So as long as I was turning my stuff in on time, like, yeah, whatever. I could go walk around the block to clear my head. I could go get coffee. I could chat with my coworkers. Like, I was given a lot of trust, and just the the sort of like encoded system that people work in these, you know, under these computer business systems is one of zero trust. Like everything is tracked, everything is timed, everything is almost automatically punished. Like, for example, there's a point systems at these, at a lot of these places like Amazon and Convergys in particular, where if you're late coming back from lunch or coming back from break or late in the morning by like 1 minute, like you get a point for that. It's penalized and it goes towards, and once you get a certain amount of points, you get fired. And it's just, there's no agency even for like middle management to say like, oh, well, this person, you know, just had a kid or something. So yeah, they're probably going to be late for a couple weeks. They're probably going to, or a couple months or whatever. Or this person is just, you know, late because they are not a good worker or because they don't care or whatever. Right now, it's just the assumption built into all of these computer systems is they are late because they're bad people and should be fired. Yeah, you are a number. And the thing I found most disturbing about it was like that most of my younger coworkers at these jobs had never experienced a job that wasn't like that. It was just completely just the way the world was. It kind of sucked, but they didn't really have that much aspiration to anything else because all of these computer systems are so, you know, widespread and common now.
They just they just never experienced anything different. I mean, that's the people used to say like all it would have taken to get the wall to come down in the Soviet Union is drop American toilet paper in the East Europe and people find out like, oh, my God, it doesn't have to be sandpaper. Things would have changed. All right. Well, just briefly, because I want to sort of just get more of like a 20,000 foot view here. But just briefly, tell us about your experience at McDonald's. Are there people? Let me ask you this. Let's just start with this. Are there, when you're sitting there at the register at McDonald's, is there someone next to you who's like worked so hard that they actually make more than you, or does everybody get paid the same at McDonald's if they have the same job?
I mean, I think there are raises, and I was working in San Francisco, so I was getting paid like distinctly more than your average person at McDonald's was. I was making $14 an hour, which still was not anywhere near enough to pay rent in San Francisco.
Right.
Or
but I'm
Oakland
saying within your
really
own
anywhere.
Restaurant, not necessarily from locality to locality.
Oh, within my own restaurant?
Yeah.
I don't know. I honestly did not get that much chance to talk to my coworkers. Like there definitely were like, this was one of the few jobs where you can really understand why the manager is the manager, because in my situation, at least, the managers were all just like the fastest and like hardest core workers on the shift. So I assume they made a little more than I did, but in general, like there's no money in being like lower management in fast food.
I'm saying, let's
food.
Say you're not management. Like, is there a differential between Billy who's working the fryer later and Mary who's working the fryer later?
Not as far as I know.
Right. Okay.
Other than how long they've been there.
Okay.
Which is generally not that long.
Well, so what's your experience there? Like how was the, Mickey D's different, or the same, I guess, as the other two?
Well, again, everything it was really closely timed. This one definitely had the added pressure of like a physical line that's there all the time. And in particular, like that one, I felt the effects of understaffing the most. Because, you know, understaffing, like you were talking about with gerrymandering, they've gotten so good at perfectly understaffing so that everybody is always in the weeds, but the customers like don't, you know, burn the place down because the line is so long.
Explain in the weeds, because you use that throughout the book, and it's an important, it gives an important sense of like, of what you're trying to do with the book in some way.
Oh yeah, like I don't know what was your initial definition of in the weeds?
Well, when I say in the weeds, that means like I'm going deep into the details of this policy discussion or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
Description of whatever I'm doing.
Right. So yeah, there's like, there's two, and that is one. And that tends to be the one that people who came from, who are more into like academic and white collar stuff have. My definition of it, the first one that I got was from like working with waitresses, and like in the weeds means like you're just fucked. Like you have so many customers, you have way too much work, you're falling further and further behind, and it's like almost impossible to dig yourself back out. So it's just like this exhausting several hours, like where you're just working as fast as you possibly can and still not being able to keep up. So what I found super interesting about that phrase is that when I got into like journalism, almost everybody seemed to have a different, that second one, your definition right. of it, and did not understand my definition of it. And I use that as sort of the central, you know, metaphor for how the way that the same thing means completely different things to these two groups of people. It's very much the same with like other words like job, or like a good job, a bad job, like a hard job, hard work. Like all of these things have completely different meanings to people on the lower end of the job market and people on the higher end of the job market. Like in to the sense where I don't think they understand each other at all. Like the people who I worked with in like Convergys that I had, you know, more of a chance to become friends with, like when I would tell them about like my old, you know, newspaper jobs and stuff like that, where I, you know, my breaks were not timed, you know, the second, and I could go out and, you know, pick up lunch without having to like freak out over being 2 minutes late, that they had no comprehension of what that would be like. Like that was not something that they expected. And it's very much the same for people on the other side. I don't think that they really realize how bad things have gotten. They're still sort of stuck on possibly their own memories of service work from like the 70s or 80s, or just their general picture of it from, I don't know, movies, or I don't know, like economics or something. But it means completely different things.
It's interesting because as I was, you know, prepping for this, it occurred to me that, you know, we just had one of the things about the ACA was that it basically made a definition of what constitutes actual health insurance, right? Like you can call something health insurance, but even though on paper it appears to be health insurance, it's really not what we're going to consider health insurance, because health insurance is just a word that we've made up, and it should mean something across the board, and it should be meaningful, the meaning of it, that the health insurance should be a meaningful thing. And it occurs to me that we have this sort of a similar problem with jobs, right? People just assume like that. I mean, just talk about that a little bit, because we're all at our job right now. But it is fundamentally different, it seems to me, than someone who is working at this type of job saying I'm at my job.
Yeah, definitely. Like honestly, if I could force members of Congress to do this, I would. I would force them to go work for a month, like in their during recess. Like they should have to go work one of these crappy jobs for a month. Like they just should. They would understand it so much better. And I think that policy would, I don't know. What do you think about this? I have been really on the fence over whether those types of people that really do have this idea of like, oh, people just aren't working hard enough, like that's why they're not succeeding, whether they don't know. Do you think they don't know? I think there's a certain
portion that they don't know, but I also think that they're the ones who are instituting those policies that are so dehumanizing that they just don't necessarily think that there is a concept. I think that's out there is if we're paying you, we get all of you. Like it's not, is it like we don't just get your we get your what we define as your labor. We don't get just your labor. That's not a narrow, you know, output. We get all of it. We own you for this period of time. And therefore what we do,
and not even just that period of time, like one of the really difficult things about, particularly retail and fast food is the way like scheduling works in that, like I was talking about earlier, they've gotten so good at understaffing by you know calculating using the data of when the store was busy, like over the last year, over the last month, over the last week. And the faster, like the more recent the data is, usually the more accurate the prediction of what staffing is going to be needed is. So that's sort of why so many people in fast food and retail don't get their schedules until like the day before it starts, which makes it completely impossible to plan anything in your life. Like you can't, you know, like figure out a doctor's appointment. Like you can request that time off, but there is no guarantee that you'll actually get it. And I think it also really steals people's, honestly, their families in a weird way. And it's not just because like, oh, you never get to see your kids or something. It's impossible, not impossible, but it's incredibly difficult to be able to maintain like a relationship, like a functional relationship with your partner and your family. If like, for example, I met tons of people who, because they were not able to afford childcare on their wages, they would work opposing shifts. Like one parent would take night shift, one person would take day shift, and they would barely ever see each other. And I like, that's not a life. Like that's not a relationship. That's not a marriage. That's like expecting people to live like that. And that's another thing that I do not think people know. There's so many people, like there's so many opinions out there about like, the decline of the family. And I don't really disagree with that, but like, it's not because of like Miley Cyrus or whatever. It's because like, it's impossible to maintain a relationship where you never get to see the other person. You're both always exhausted. And like, everything is an irritant, sort of like everything that comes up is like just something to another stress to add on top of it.
And I would add too, that, you know, the idea of going to see, you know, your kids, baseball game or your, you know, their class project or taking a trip with them, you know, one day, like there's zero flexibility for that. Simply not possible. Do you have a sense? Well, all right. Let me ask you this. I mean, we have, by all accounts, rising rates of stress and anxiety. Just read an ad for an app. Meditation app, Calm, yep, that cited the World Health Organization, said stress is the the number one. Like, do you think, to what extent is this, you know, what this does to in terms of stress and anxiety?
So basically all of the three jobs that I chose, like sort of as examples of not just jobs that exist right now, but jobs that are very sort of successful in the market, I guess, and ones that are likely to sort of spread, like these methods are likely to spread in the same way that like Walmart's methods of treating their workers sort of spread throughout the 90s. So I picked them because they're probably going to spread like even further than they have now. And one of the things about constantly stressful jobs, regardless of what ways that they're chronically stressful, is that you kind of can't get used to chronic stress. Like there's a lot of talk about like hard work, but like hard work and like hard work, difficult work, that is really different from chronically stressful work. It's a different thing. And chronic stress makes you sick. Like if you are chronically stressed, like A, it just demolishes your body. Like if you're setting your fight or flight reaction off like all day, every day, which a lot of these jobs are sort of designed to do so that you work faster, it will just like completely burn out your organs, like your, particularly your heart, but like also your immune system. You tend to be more prone to obesity and drug abuse and basically anything that sort of helps you. All of the things that we regard as sort of like ills that make you feel better. Mine in particular was McDonald's and like just food in general. But a lot of people like, and also cigarettes was one of mine. Cigarettes is a big one for a lot of people. Drugs, just things that make you feel better that aren't necessarily good for you. And it also has a lot of behavioral, chronic stress has a lot of behavioral effects that I find like really interesting in the context of like, you know, what America's doing right now. And not just America, but like, you know, like Britain and France, like all of these first world countries are starting to sort of exhibit the same sorts of symptoms, I think, in that like chronic stress makes you irritable. It makes you paranoid. It like, it's sort of like picture like a Mad Max world like that for most of human, you know, history, biological history, evolutionary history. That was the only way that you would be getting your fight or flight pinged dozens and dozens and dozens of times a day is if like an actual like apocalyptic event had happened, like right. A volcano went off and ruined everything. And you were always going to have to fight for food every single day, every single meal. Like in that sense, like in that sort of environment, it would kind of make sense to be like much more ready to fight somebody, like irritable, like your sex drive would dry up because it doesn't make any sense to, you know, to reproduce in that environment. Like you would be, it would make sense not to, to sort of just like not leave the house if you had enough food, which like to me like is kind of depression. It makes sense to be constantly alert, like anxiety. And it also makes sense to like kind of mistrust people that aren't from your immediate tribe or your family, people that aren't like you. Like when humans live in times of like, of when there's enough resources to go around, which is most of human history, because we were fine with eating bugs back in the day. And, you know, there's plenty of bugs. Like we are kind of a naturally cooperative species. Like that's how we kind of beat out all the other species. Frankly, like we have these big old brains and they allow us to like work together to accomplish things that we cannot accomplish alone. But when it's, and that's for most of the time, but when it gets, when things get really bad, then you sort of like go out on your own and you protect only the people who are closest to you and everyone else can go fuck themselves. And that's sort of what I think we're in today because of the way that we work and the way that we sort of treat our workers as if they should have to, you know, constantly be pushed into doing the work that they honestly kind of already want to do. They just
want to do it
at a normal
pace. Right.
Yeah.
All right. So lastly, let me ask you this. Do we have a sense of how many people, like, I mean, if there was a way for you to define this type of work, like, you know, work that is done that has constant temporal benchmarks that exist throughout the day without relief at any point or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. Do we have a sense of how many people are in these jobs? I mean, I'm not talking like, you know, like FAA, you know, air traffic controllers probably have a similar type of stress, but it's stress, but it's a little bit different. And they also, you know, they're conscious of like, we need to give people a break. We need to, I mean, that's built into the system because they know that there's stressful. This we don't, because they just get rid of the people. And if they blow it once, they get rid of them and it's not like a plane goes down. But do we have a sense of like how many people are on the clock, as you call it, I guess, of these type of jobs?
Well, it's a really, that took me kind of a long time to figure out exactly what number to use for that. So what I ended up with after kind of a lot of research was there was this very interesting paper from out of Oxford in, I think it was 2013, that was looking at the potential for automation in various jobs in the U.S., and in particular, they were looking at the degree to which jobs are routinized and sort of de-skilled to the point where you didn't really need to be a human to do them anymore. Like, so like stuff like cashiers, you know, you don't like you used to be able to like actually make change and like do math in your head. And now like I go into a Wawa and like buy something and the person hands me the dollars and the change is automatically dispensed into like a little cup that I pick up. Like that's just another de-skilling part. And so this study found that like I think it was 47% of American jobs were so routinized and de-skilled that they were like very much in danger of being, you know, fully automated within the next, I think it was 25 years.
Wow.
So yeah, that's the number I find the most persuasive.
It's stunning. The book is On the Clock, What Low Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. Emily Gundersberger will put a link to your book on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really interesting.
Thanks.
All right, folks. Wowza.
I remember reading Nickel and Dimed. That sounds like a good update to it.
Yes. The technology, like, on some level, right, like this is doing a similar thing. Not quite, but close.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I mean, not nearly as intense. And it's and you can put it down. I mean, you could literally walk away from it. But vehicles of control for productivity, broadly speaking. But this is super, super intense. The idea of that Amazon worker having to constantly hit those benchmarks seems relentless. Absolutely relentless. And I mean, I think to a certain extent, like, you know, this is at one point you have a National Labor Relations Board that says, this is not a job. It's not a job. Like, it's not a job. We have, there are concepts in the law as to, like, you know, what you're allowed to sign a contract to go and do. And it's just not a job. And so, I mean, look, we already have the idea that we have worker safety things, you know, we have standards of worker safety, physical safety in a job site. You can take a job for $100 an hour, but there are minimum standards as to how safe it can be or has to be for it to work. And it's very much like, you know, the idea of a minimum wage. I mean, the bottom line is like, we as a society that has progressed has the right to say that if you're going to operate a business within the context of our society, then there are certain standards we must require. We have requirements as to protecting consumers. You cannot put in lead into candy, even if it makes the candy super cheap.
In a certain sense.
Even if people are like, lead candy?
Innovation.
I mean, the lead you can barely taste, and it's like, it costs a penny. I'll take it. We just don't allow that. It's not in society's best interest to do so. It's not in society's best interest to allow work that could kill you. And it should also be recognized that it's not in society's best interest to have work that drives you insane or mildly insane. Even if you want to do it, sorry. We're just not going to allow this because it creates a dynamic, a protection dynamic. Look, we make these decisions as a society all the time. We make them in terms of vaccinations. Certain vaccinations will not be effective unless we require everyone to use them. And we see plenty of examples of this. You want to drive in the roads, you've got to be on the right side of the road.
Well, I think this is just one more example of the kamikaze death drive embedded within capitalism. And because, like I've said before, if there's nobody to work for you, if everybody's dead of an opiate overdose or they stress injuries or whatever, they can't work for you, and there's no capitalism because there's no society. So you can deal with it by making regulations. You can deal with it when workers rise up and form a union and help each other out. You can deal with it with, you know, my favorite thing, communism, but we got to deal with it somehow.
Right. I mean, it's just simply not sustainable. And I mean, that's basically the bottom line. It's just not sustainable to do this to people on a regular basis. And that means it's going to cost you X percentage more to have your toothbrush sent to you from Amazon or whatever it is. And that's just the way that society is going to work. That it's just, you know, there has been a decision made in society that it's all going to be about cheap products. And there is a presumption that we have all participated in this decision by seeking out the cheaper of two products when we're going to purchase something, right? That we're making our decisions with our dollars. But the fact of the matter is that as a society, we have not given informed consent to this decision. We have not been it is very easy to see that toothbrush A costs 25 cents less than toothbrush B, but all of the forces that make that price differential are kept from us. All of the implications of that, all of the externalities of that are hidden from us. And so we have not made that decision as a society with any type of informed consent. And I suspect that if we really understood it, that we wouldn't make that decision.
Well, the bosses certainly would. I mean, that's what they're incentivized to do by capitalism. It's not just personal greed. It's not just them being bad people, although I'm sure that they are. It is, you are incentivized to maximize profits however you can, and that involves treating your workers like robots.
Yeah, and the irony is, and I you know, again, this may be one of those interviews that I keep referring to, is that sometimes that screws you. Like, you get so blind to the idea of cutting labor costs and weakening labor that you end up, shooting yourself in the foot. And that is the U.S. car company story. And I'm going to try not to keep giving more stuff away from the interview so that people actually tune into it during our break. All right. Speaking of break. Wow, we've gone late today, but we're going to go late. Hey, folks, like I said earlier, Proactiv is America's number one acne brand, and it has helped fight acne for like 25 years.
I used to use it a little bit, too.
Did actually. You?
Yeah.
Well, Kelly apparently used it big time, and now they have the next generation of Proactiv acne treatment stuff. It's called Proactiv MD. It's dermatologist-recommended topical retinoid used in the treatment of mild to moderate acne. And order now and you will receive Proactiv's on-the-go bag, which features their T-Zone oil absorber, their body acne wipes, and their green tea moisturizer for free. That's close to $100 in value. Plus, you get free shipping with a 60-day money-back guarantee. Just go to proactiv.com/majority. That's proactiv.com/majority. Particularly if you know somebody who's going back to school, who's having some acne issues. Nice thing to get them. Particularly now is a good time. Clear that stuff up before you get back to school. It gives you a lot more confidence going back. Kids can be rather difficult and self-conscious.
They get out there. They have a good time.
Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, and then we give you extra content every day, commercial-free, and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Don't forget to check out the AM Quickie. It's in your Majority Report feed. It won't be there indefinitely, so now's the time to check it out. Tonight is Tuesday night.
Indeed.
Is it Tuesday already?
It's Tuesday already.
Gosh.
I feel you. Professor Richard Wolff returns. He's in studio. We're talking about the modern economic history of the People's Republic of China. What is the economic system of China? What is state capitalism? What is communism and Chinese characteristics, as they've called it? We're also talking about alienation, primitive accumulation, a mini illicit history of Pakistan, Afghanistan, alienation specifically as it relates potentially to ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and white supremacist terrorism. At 6:10-ish, there's going to be a pre-stream on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel with Murtaza Hussein. We're going to be talking about specifically what's happening in Kashmir. Patreon.com/TMBS to get the whole thing.
Jamie. Oh,
sorry. Get your Chicago tickets. They're going fast, and that's August 24th. So we'll see you there in Chicago with Chuck Mertz soon.
This week on the Antifada, I was away at the DSA convention, so the boys recorded an episode without me. I have only a very short and vague list.
I tried to time it for the when the boys did it without me.
Indeed.
Sorry.
I have a short and vague list of what it's about that Andy just sent me. I'm not even 100% sure I understand all of these things, but it includes the MK Ultra Left, Juggalos, Manson, Jake Flores, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I get all that. Matt?
Yeah, coming up for patrons this week is A Hanging, an essay by a young man named Eric Arthur Blair when he was 28. This was before he was George Orwell, and that's just going to be for patrons, so look forward to that, patrons.
There you go, patrons. Quick break, fun half, right now.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, back, back. Back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a man.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Homo says what?
What?
Homo says what?
Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them! 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 Fuck
things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.